Well, hello everyone. We'll call a meeting to order. I don't know if we have a quorum yet. Looks like we might. So, Representative Bly says we do, so he approves the minutes of the yesterday's meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we have with us this morning, Judge Haney, do you want to start coming up towards the table up there? We have with us a good friend of Mary Murphy's and mine from in Duluth, the Honorable Gerald Haney, who is here today just to give his input on what he thinks should happen with tuition here in the state of Minnesota. Judge Haney is originally, I think, from somewhere in southern Minnesota, right, Your Honor? He was on the Board of Regents, appointed by President Johnson to the federal bench and served on the 8th District Court of Appeals, was a good Democrat, part of that great generation, landed on Omaha Beach during D-Day, has this flag that he's put up at some of our events that was given to him, sewn by either Czech or Slovaks, I can't remember. Which one was it? But there's no Czechoslovakians anywhere. They're either Czechs or Slovaks, so you don't know which. I went down to his apartment here recently, and my mother had told me when I was going down, well, you know, he was a good friend of your father's, and so I said to him, Your Honor, you've known me for 20-some years. You never told me that you knew my dad. He said, well, there's a lot of Rukavinas. I didn't, you know. But that was my father that was active in the Democratic Farmer Labor Party with you, Your Honor. So welcome to the committee. It's an honor to have you here. And you can just go ahead and identify yourself and start with your testimony.
I'm Gerald Haney. I live in Duluth. I was born in Goodyear, attended Goodyear Public High School, St. Thomas College, and graduated from the University of Minnesota Law School in 1941. I got a call yesterday afternoon from the young woman who was here from the Minnesota Daily, and she asked me, how come you're coming down to testify before the Committee of Higher Education of the House? You're a retired judge. What's your interest in this? And I told her, and I'll tell you, that the state of Minnesota provided me with superb education. I went to the University of Minnesota Law School. I told you, graduated in 1941. At that time, the tuition was only $250 a semester, $500 a year. And by working in the summer and by working at school, I was able to graduate without owing anybody anything. So when I see these young students coming to work for me as law clerks that owe a lot of money, I think back and I wonder why it is that we aren't supporting higher education at a higher level than we do now. In that regard, as I looked over the figures, and I'm sure you're aware of them, when I was going to school back in 1941, the state was spending about 5.5% of its gross product for higher education. Today we're spending about 3.5% of our gross product for higher education. And that, if you're looking for a reason, that's the reason that students are graduating from our public colleges and universities with the debt that they now have. And I think we can and should do better for higher education than we have been doing. As I said, it was possible for me to graduate without a debt because at that time the state of Minnesota was picking up the 60% of the cost of kids that went to law school. Now they're picking up about 30%. And that translates into, again, the higher debt that the students have at the present time. Today, my concerns are twofold as far as the students who graduate from universities and from other public colleges are concerned. First of all, they graduate, a lot of them graduate with a huge debt. And I understand you've had some students in testifying before you this week. And that does two things. First of all, it means that those students have limited opportunities as to where they can go to work, because they've got to get a job that will enable them to pay off the debt that they owe for their higher education. And on the other hand, it means that some very highly qualified and motivated young men and women who graduate from our colleges and universities are not able to go into public service or into nonprofits or so forth. And I think that has meant that we lose an awful lot of good people that should be going into those jobs that are not going into them at the present time. Now, Governor Pawlenty initially proposed that we give free tuition to kids that graduate from the upper 25% of their class for 2 years. And I understand that that program would have cost about $80 million a year or $160 million for the biennium. I think that was a good proposal. But I really believe that we'd be better served if we took that $160 million and added that to our grants and aid program, so it would go to students not only on the basis of merit, but go on the basis of both merit and need. Now, if we did that, if we put the money that Governor Pawlenty recommended for higher education for the student end of it, if we put that into the student aid fund, we'd be able to increase the average grant from $2,400 up to a little over $4,000. And I think that would be extremely worthwhile. Now, there's a lot of recent literature on what's happening in our colleges today, and I'm sure that most of you have read it as I have, and that indicates that we're putting most of our money today not into grants and aid for students, but we're putting it into tuition for the most highly qualified students. In other words, the upper 5 or 10% get scholarships and they can go wherever they want, whether it be a public or a private university. But that means that we aren't beginning to put the money that we need into grants and aids for good students who come from low and moderate income families and who need to have some help if they're going to go to college and if they're going to make the contributions to the state of Minnesota that we need them to make. And so my feeling is that I'd like to see this committee and the state legislature take the governor's proposal of $80 million a year that we're going to give to fund free tuition and to add that to the grant and aid program so that we can make it possible for more students of ability to go to college in the state of Minnesota and to graduate without the horrific debts that they now have. I'd be pleased to answer any questions that any of you may have.
Any questions for Ms. Haney? Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to offer a comment, and thank you very much for coming today to speak with us. I appreciate what you've said, and especially one of the things when you talked about when our students leave with such high debt that they can't go into public service or provide more community nonprofit kind of work, and I think that that's a significant piece. It's something that hasn't been raised as much by the students looking at what their debt is. And so I just thank you for that comment. I think that's an appropriate one, and we should be paying heed to that. So thank you.
Representative Portman, and all the, Your Honor, the attorneys are jumping in here. We've got a question from one, and another one just walked in appropriately. So, Representative Portman.
Judge Haney, I graduated from the University of Minnesota Law School in 1995, and clerking with you was one of the most sought-after clerkships that people talked about. And people on the committee should know how highly regarded Judge Haney is by law students, law professors, and your former clerks, one of whom asked me to pass along her best wishes, Margaret Hobday. This judge is so beloved by the people who work with him that there's a community of Judge Haney clerks that get together and remain in contact with the judge and with each other. So I just wanted to let you know that Margaret says hello and was thrilled that you would be here to talk about this, and also very impressed by your passion on this issue.
Well, thank you. I've had 70 law clerks in the 40 years that I was on the court. I think that made... That was the best thing about the job. Even better than being able to make decisions that affected a lot of people. To work with these young, bright kids, most of whom were from the university, some of whom came from other colleges, but this was a great thing to be able to work with these young people. They're so bright. Most of them are a lot smarter than I was. And to keep and to be able to work with them on getting ready for court and drafting opinions and working together. So give my best to Margaret. She certainly was one of my very best law clerks that I had.
I'll pass that along.
And it's a wonderful training ground for the law clerks, and I was pleased to have been able to have 70, practically all of whom graduated from the University of Minnesota, with a few from William Mitchell and one or two from Harvard that,
Okay, if there are no further questions, then, Your Honor, thank you very much for making the trip down, and I want to thank your good friend George Sundstrom for driving you down, too. George is up there in the audience, former business agent for, the sheet metal workers of the Duluth and Iron Range area. So, and actually was a candidate at one time for the Board of Regents, too, I believe. Your Honor?
Yes, well, thank you very much,
thank you,
Representative, and I hope that this committee can do something to make it possible for the kids of today to have the opportunity that I had so many years ago to go to the University of Minnesota and to do it and to graduate without having a huge debt on my shoulders. And I know you can do it, and I think that the state should do it because it will contribute to the welfare and the goodness of the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your contribution to the committee and for caring as much as you do, Your Honor. We'd like to welcome Representative Westrum to the committee, too. He's here today, I'm sure, because his constituent is going to be testifying. Welcome to him. So why don't we just get going then? We have the campuses of
Mr. Chair, I just had one comment. I really appreciated the testimony, but I was a little alarmed when I heard there were a lot more Rukavinas up there on the range.
Well, actually, it's kind of a name like Anderson or Jones in Croatia, but, you should be alarmed. First, we're going to have testimony from the Crookston campus. We have Dr. Lyle Westrum and Dr. Mark Karenin. So we got a Finn and a relative of Tories, evidently. So. Welcome to the committee. Why don't you guys just identify yourselves for the tape when you start and go right into your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Recovina, committee members, guests. I'm Lyle Westrum, 18-year faculty member in the Agriculture Department at the University of Minnesota, Crookston.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Karenin. I'm an assistant professor of chemistry at the University of Minnesota, Crookston. I've been there for 2 years now.
We prepared a little PowerPoint for you to share some of our thoughts with, and we really appreciate the opportunity to visit with you about faculty perspectives from the University of Minnesota Crookston. Notice we took the shot in the summertime. It's a little prettier in the summer with the flowers. But I draw your attention to the map. First of all, we're the most remote campus of the university system. If you note where Crookston is, we're 3 hours south of Winnipeg and 5 hours northwest of the Twin Cities. And so that location is unique, and I think you'll see as we share a testimony that benefits us in a couple of ways, and it's a challenge in a couple of ways as well. As an aside, Mark and I are both natives of Minnesota from sparsely populated areas. Mark is from St. Louis County, and I grew up in Grant County. If we take a look at the map of the University of Minnesota Crookston, you'll see in the upper right-hand corner, we share several different entities at the university. In the upper right-hand corner is the Northwest Research and Outreach Center. A long time and reputable research center, does a lot of research, especially in the crop area, sugar beets, small grains, and so on. Across the street from there, you'll find the Agulization Research Institute, and located just above it is a regional center for extension. So we feel very privileged to have those entities shared with us on our campus. We're part of the University of Minnesota, and our mission ties in very closely to the whole university. It's integral to the whole state, part of the land-grant mission. And we believe very strongly in the land-grant mission, and are proud to be a part of it. Our programs at Crookston combine theory, practice, and experimentation in a technologically rich environment. And, of course, teaching, research, and outreach are important for the public good in the state of Minnesota. Well, who is the University of Minnesota Crookston? We're unique in the Northwest region. We provided access to the University of Minnesota, which is certainly a world-renowned institution for teaching, research, and outreach. But we provide access in the northern part of the state. We are an attractive setting for first-generation students. You might be interested in knowing that nearly 70% of our student body are first-generation students. We also provide an access to a population that attends college at the lowest rate. You look at high school seniors in the state of Minnesota, the area we serve attends college at the lowest rate. We think it's very important that the university have a presence in that kind of a setting. We have equal tuition access across the board to out-of-state and international students. That has had an impact. We have nearly 100 more international students than we did just a year ago. So we're pleased to provide that access. We want to say thanks to you and to several other funding agencies. We have several facilities that have been enhanced or built during the last 8-10 years, and I'd like to visit with you just about a few of those. First of all, Berglund Laboratory is a plant science laboratory shared between the Northwest Research and Outreach Center and the University of Minnesota Crookston, and we think that, again, that ties back to that relationship that we think is unique to our campus and beneficial to both sides. There are a lot of growth chambers in this area, and it's been a wonderful facility for faculty to work in. Teal Hall is a little bit of nostalgia restored. We have utilized it for meeting rooms, our computer center, and if we take a look here, you'll see the auditorium. And if you look closely, it might be a little difficult to see where you're at, but the murals on the side are nearly 100 years old, and they're restored. And if you ever get a chance, I invite you to have a look at those murals. People come and just study them there. And then, of course, the rest of the auditorium was remodeled, but the murals remained intact. If we go to Bede Student Center, one of our newest buildings, just a couple of years old, about a year and a half old, our students just thoroughly enjoyed our new student center. It has connected the two halves of our campus, and once you enter, the majority of our campus students can stay inside the entire time, going from one side to the other. I want to let you have a little look here off to the side of the interior of the student center. And looking at many of you, you have that a bit of gray hair that I do as well. And this might not be the place that you and I would relish as much as our students do. You notice the stools and the higher chairs, and then you've got the game area off to the back and a social area behind, and a part you can't see would be the tables. And this is full every day. And they thrive in that setting of what I almost think is chaos, but they love to study in that environment. It's really been a positive thing for our students. We want to say thank you for that. Centennial Hall is a modern housing facility with apartment-style living with a shared room. You look across college campuses, as I had four children and did so, and many campuses, probably an area that's fallen behind, and many of them is housing, so we're really pleased to have this new housing option available to our students. Just a quick look at the interior of the rooms there. Going on, and our heating plant update is currently in progress, and it's going to improve the efficiency of our coal-operated system. It's also an enhancement to the back of our campus, and it may not look like that now. This is a picture in progress, but we are looking at making the north side of our campus more attractive because we have added onto our campus the Heathline University Teaching and Outreach Center, and it has on the north side. So some of the results that faculty-driven and, of course, in cooperation with the administration that we're really proud of, we received last spring a 10-year accreditation from the Higher Learning Commission. And that took a lot of time and effort, but we're really pleased to have that. We have integrated and have become known as a service learning institution. We have over half of our faculty that have incorporated service learning into one or more of their classes. And last year, students logged 11,000 hours in service learning. And on a small campus, we're very proud of that. We're also a leader in online degrees. We have three available now. We've been given, the Higher Learning Commission gave us an option to proceed without limit in that area. So the two work together. You know, our faculty vision can easily be summed up in two words: student learning. We think if there's anything we can do to enhance student learning is the real key. And to use an analogy, I'm a teacher educator and I work with student teachers in agricultural education. When we supervise student teachers, I tell them before they go out, we're going to watch you very little. We're going to watch the students in your classrooms. Are the students learning? That's the key. And that's what we feel as a faculty, that's the real key, is student learning. Just a few shots of our classrooms. You notice the laptops. That's an everyday thing for our students. We were the original laptop university. That culture continues to thrive, and students just carry it with them every day. It's like a pencil to them. This is our early childhood center. We're fortunate to have a lab right on campus. So this is one of our students working with a couple of youngsters. We think it's important to have those early experiences, also student teaching options available right on our campus. It's an important thing to Northwestern Minnesota. Here's a shot of our natural resource department. It's kind of the one-on-one kind of education that we pride ourselves in and can offer at the University of Minnesota Crookston. We do have some faculty needs, and if you look at filling faculty needs, you'll see that it's the students that really benefit in that case. And I want to visit with you about a few of the needs that we do have at the University of Minnesota Crookston. First of all, we need a little more support for our current programs. We are actually looking for the first program area budget increase in 30 years. That might come as a surprise to you, but in our individual programs, for the travels we might have, the supplies, the expenses, so on, we have not had a budget increase in over 30 years. In fact, some of the budgets are operating at a 10% reduction from what they were 30 years ago, even with the dramatically increased transportation costs and things. So we would like, of course, additional faculty members. We have 42. That's been leveled to a slight drop over the last 5 years. We think we need additional faculty members for our students. We, as I mentioned before, we're really proud of the buildings and facilities we have on campus, but perhaps the area we are in greatest need is when you look inside, and when you try to recruit new faculty members, the thing they note and tell us is that the laboratories need additional equipment and materials inside. That's the area that is either obsolete or missing, and so we would really appreciate that. Some increased instructional dollars are important. In addition to the things we currently have, and those programs are operating well, but we need a few more programs to fulfill the needs of our students in that area. We have a limited number of majors, and sometimes students have to leave to go elsewhere because we don't have a major. So we would certainly like some additional programs. We support President Brunix and his call for leveling up the tuition for students. We especially feel that in the Northwest, because we compete with UND, NDSU, Virginia State, Morehead State, and so we certainly would like to see that tuition leveled out. One of the things that we now want to be a part of President Brunix's call to become one of the top three research institutions in the world, even though we know our focus will still remain primarily teaching, but our young faculty are expected to do much more research than they did just a few years ago. And we think we need startup funds for those new faculty, and that is something we'd like to see incorporated on our campus. The last thing that we are kind of in need of is a contract for our faculty. Tomorrow we begin our third year without a real contract in place for our faculty. And we think the faculty and ultimately the students will benefit by bringing that contract to fruition. With that returns us to the beginning, and as I said, we're really pleased to be here, and we want to open it up to any questions you might have for either one of us. We'll attempt to answer them.
Dr. Kernan, do you have anything to add? Or you're not related to the Kernans from Brick, are you, by any chance?
No, we're pretty concentrated in the Ely area, so there might be some connections there that I don't know about.
Questions for either of the witnesses, Representative Murphy first, and then Poppy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, you said that you're the original laptop university, and then you talked about the large number of degrees online that were given online. Do your faculty that teach online get additional amounts of money for their work online?
Yes, and it's difficult to give there isn't an easy answer to that question, because it depends if they're teaching, if they would be teaching full load, regular classes, then did some online in addition, they would be paid extra for that. But if it's part of their load, then that might be treated slightly differently. They might be an off-campus person who is hired specifically, if we don't have anyone available on campus, and specifically for the online. Mark, do you want to add anything to that? So.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Doctor, you said that the last point was that you had a need for a contract, and this was the third year that you're without a contract.
That's correct. Well, tomorrow will be the first day of a third year again.
First day of the third year. Yeah. And so has the faculty been unwilling to negotiate?
Well, we don't think so. No, we've been negotiating. But on the other hand, you know, I understand we're representing one side. But
we'll hear the other side later. So.
We're part of Unit 9, which the law... FELRA calls for any outstate university campuses that are unionized to be one unit, and Duluth and Crookston are, and so we are one unit with them. We, 2 years ago, beginning 2 years ago, we knew Duluth had a contract in place when we joined the union, and so we negotiated it for almost a year with very little progress, and then right at the end of the year we did arrive at what we called a mini contract that dealt with basically just salary and grievance procedure, and that was it. All the rest was left undone. We have been then immediately, and actually before that was done, completed, we started negotiating a 1 to 3 year contract with Duluth. We have met, I just counted this morning, 30 times, 30 different days, and sometimes full days and sometimes less, but most of the time, majority of each day. And at this point, we do not have an agreement.
Mr. Chairman, I asked that question because I used to carry a bill for first-time negotiations, and this is a first-time negotiation, right?
Correct.
And, Mr. Chairman, Dr. Weston put in that, or said that they're part of Unit 9, and so until Crookston is settled, Duluth doesn't get settled either. And so I think that it behooves the university to make a greater effort and to get a contract settled, because that is something that's on my list this year. To walk.
Representative Murphy, and I'm well aware of it too, for the members, information for the members, the Duluth campus was the only organized campus until Crookston organized a couple of years ago, and as Mr. Westrom indicated, I don't know if it's in power law or not. That's something I'd like to check on, and maybe Representative Atkins, who chairs the Labor Commerce Committee, could look at that, but I understand that Duluth basically has settled their contract, but because you folks are still negotiating over these long 2 years, beginning your third year, that contract can't be, the Duluth contract can't be settled until you're settled with them. So,
but 3 years is a long time.
It's a very long time, Representative Murphy, and perhaps, the folks from the university might be able to see the frustration even with some of the members, and perhaps you can look at something, work with Representative Atkins on looking at the possibility that maybe you could be individual if you chose to be units. I don't know what the problem is there.
Thank you.
You've been Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm over here. Professor Westrom, you mentioned that you have 42 full-time faculty. Could you tell me how many adjuncts or part-time faculty?
Yeah, that's tenure track. We probably have an additional, Mark, let me ask you to help me. Is it an additional 20 adjunct and temporary faculty?
I would say 2 is the maximum.
Yeah.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, and as far as the number of faculty that you said you'd like to be able to add some more full-time faculty, do you have particular areas of need in certain departments?
Emily?
We have some areas that we do have a need. We also have some additional program areas we would like to add where we can bring in new faculty as well.
And just one final, so if you add more faculty in a program area, you likely would see an increase in students within that program area?
We think so. Yes, we do. And we could retain some students we currently have that are forced to leave because we don't have the program for them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Parkman.
I was wondering what the specific programs are you're looking at adding.
Well, we've looked at several. Biology is probably one that we've been in. Mark, why don't you take that, being that's your area?
We have very few what one could call traditional programs on campus, basic sciences and arts. We've looked at recently, and these programs are kind of in the pipeline, a biology degree. Applied psychology is one that's coming along as well. Having seen some survey data that came in very recently, we've also had large numbers of interest in degrees like environmental science. Journalism has come up, nursing. So a lot of the programs that are found in abundance on other campuses, we don't have at the moment.
There's a couple ways we could enhance current majors we do have. Small animals, for example, companion animals is a growing area, and very few colleges offer that.
And we have, of course, the strong equine program, and so it would be a natural fit, and we have, so we think that would be a good fit as well.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in addition to Representative Poppy's questions, I represent Bemidji and East, and many people from Bemidji, and I teach at Bemidji State University, actually will transfer to your school if they're interested in horticulture or other more traditionally agricultural-based programs. And you have quite a reputation in northern Minnesota for excellence in that, and attract students because of it. I guess I wanted to say that and just thank you for your work. But I also, and given Representative Poppy's point of question, I would encourage you in program growth to not compete with Bemidji State University in the programs that you develop. As it is, we have flat enrollment at both of our campuses, and it seems that we right now have a good relationship in compatible yet some different areas of excellence, and would encourage you to grow in that direction.
But that's a good point. And in fact, we might make mention that early childhood is one program that we share with Bemidji right now, working very well, just like the agriculture education program that I did with is shared with the Twin Cities campus. I will be leaving here in a bit to go teach a class from the Twin Cities campus that's normally I would teach from the Kirsten campus via ITV. So that sharing with and cooperation is a very important collaboration.
Now, Representative Westrom, welcome again to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know I'm not on this committee, but I appreciate your indulgence. Representative Moe might be interested, but I'm just wondering if the witness could tell us how the Bemidji students blend with the Crookston students, being the Bemidji students as an alumni, we're always a little smarter because we could do it in 4 days what they could do in five. So how do they blend that now? either witness can answer that.
I didn't anticipate this year, but since you've opened it, yeah, we try to give our students a five-day education. We think it's important to give them their money's worth. Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, that's been an ongoing joke in our family discussions for several years.
Mr. Chairman, we're creating a Bemidji caucus, and I'm assuming that Representative Westrom would like to join.
Okay, there are no further questions. Thank you both very much for coming down.
Thank you.
Long
Thank you.
Journey. How cold was it this morning?
Well, we actually traveled here last night.
Oh, mythical.
So we don't know how cold it was in Kirsten. It was cold enough here in the Twin Cities.
Morris Campus, Dr. Peter Wyckoff. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Wyckoff. Tell us about that windmill that Representative Westrom built for you out there. He's leaving, though. Welcome to St. Paul. I took a little trip out there when I was campaigning this fall, and Morrison, it's nice to see that pretty big-sized windmill there above the horizon of the dawn.
We're trying to get two more for the same rate. So. Thank you for having me here today, and thank you for Representative Westrom, who apparently just had to leave. If you have questions about the campus, his wife is a student at the University of Minnesota Morris, so he has intimate knowledge of the campus, as well as he's a rep. My name is Pete Wyckoff, and I'm an associate professor of biology. I am a native of Minnesota. I grew up in the sparsely populated county of Ramsey, right next to the state fairgrounds. I'm here to represent the University of Minnesota Morris, a special campus that seeks to replicate the education offered by our best private colleges, but at public school prices, and that's the key kicker there. Between one-third and one-half of the students attending Morris are first-generation college students. We have the highest minority student enrollment of any U of M campus, mostly owing to a tuition waiver offered to qualified Native American students. At the University of Minnesota Morris, we provide a great undergraduate education. Classes are small, and every class is taught by a professor. We don't have any graduate students, and we don't have any graduate teaching assistants. My primary job is to teach undergraduate students, and I love it. I know my students by name. I know their stories. And I give them heck when they slack off. So it's a nice, intimate place. If you listen to public radio, I'm sure you've heard our sponsored clip bragging that Morris is one of the top five public liberal arts colleges in the entire nation. And I hold that the bragging is warranted. Fewer than half of our students come from the Twin Cities. The bulk come from outstate Minnesota, with a fraction from other states. 8% of our students come off of farms. The students we serve at the University of Minnesota Morris have great financial need. As a measure of that need, over a quarter of our students receive federal Pell Grants. That's the highest of the four university campuses, and far higher than our typical Minnesota private college peer. Pell money doesn't go as far as it used to. 10 years ago, a Pell Grant covered 69% of tuition at our school. Today it covers 49%. Over the past 5 years, tuition at the University of Minnesota in general has risen 57%. That rise was not set by our campus, but was a system-wide decision. Comprehensive costs, tuition, room and board, and fees for attending the University of Minnesota Morris rose 53% over that five-year period and currently stand at almost $17,000 a year. How have our students dealt with that rise in costs? The answer, short, is they have accumulated debt. Our students at the University of Minnesota Morris accumulate debt at a greater pace than at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, but graduate with lower average indebtedness because we tend to get them done in 4 years, something some of our peer campuses struggle with. 2006 graduates left Morris with an average of $22,000 in debt, and three-fourths of our students graduated with debt. That number is higher than the other University of Minnesota campuses because our students come from lower-income families. Another way to look at the same numbers, for our students who take on debt, the average debt accumulation is around $30,000. Over the past 5 years, the amount of federal and state loans available to and taken by the typical University of Minnesota Morris students haven't really changed. What have changed are private loans. For the 2001-2002 school year, the 1,500-plus Morris students who took loans took out a cumulative grand total of $35,000. That's for the whole group in private loans. For the 2005-2006 school year, the same 1,500-size students taking out loans took out a grand total of $2.4 million. $35,000 to $2.4 million in private loans in just 5 years. Besides taking out loans, our students are working more off-campus. On-campus jobs are harder to come by, mostly because of a drop in state, not federal, but state work-study money, which has been halved. From discussions with students and colleagues, I can tell you that many of our students are forced to work so many hours that their grades and progress suffer. Despite our tuition increase, money is tight at the University of Minnesota Morris. I arrived at Morris 6 years ago, and in those 6 years, my biology classes have continued to grow, but my course and lab budgets have shrunk. I make do, but at some point, the quality of the education is going to start to decline. Why is money tight? The answer is the same for everybody. One of our big drivers of increased cost is increased health care for our employees. Another is a decline in the percentage of our costs covered by state aid. We are not living extravagantly at the University of Minnesota Morris. I can't speak for the other campuses. And I don't feel that we waste either the taxpayers' or our students' money. The costs go up, the price goes up, and money is still tight. My last point, I think, is the most important. As much as I worry about the debt incurred by the students who attend Morris, I am more worried about the students who don't even show up. As I mentioned, we serve a lot of first-generation college students, just like Crookston. And for many in that group, the sticker price alone keeps them from applying. We don't even get a chance to try to make it work for them. I teach a two-week summer program each summer for high school students. 2 summers ago, my best student came from outstate Minnesota, the daughter of 2 non-college educated parents. She really wanted to come to Morris and complete our pre-medical curriculum, but the sticker price made her parents push her away from Morris. She is now at a Minsky school that I'm sure is great on many levels, but is not a place that can get her to medical school. At the University of Minnesota Morris, we can get your students to medical school, and we do. three or four more students with B averages or better apply to medical school, who apply to medical school get in. Those numbers compare very favorably to our much higher priced private peers. I don't feel that Minnesota can afford to let the price of its university, slip out of reach for talented students of modest means. I thank you for your time, and I'm glad to answer any questions.
Thank you for coming. Question for Dr. Wyckoff. Thank you. Dr. Michael Mullins from the Duluth campus. Welcome. Start right in, Dr.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Rukavina, and all members of the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Policy Committee. I would like to take a moment to thank you all for having invited us today and for your continued interest in higher education and its plight. My name is Michael Mullins, and I'm on the faculty at the University of Minnesota Duluth campus in the College of Liberal Arts, the Department of Foreign Languages and Literature. I instruct the German language and culture courses and spend 2 months, most years in Germany, one which is spent instructing short-term study abroad program in Berlin, which I've organized for the University of Minnesota. Today I speak to you as a member of UEA, the University Education Association. We're the Higher Ed Collective Bargaining Group affiliated with Education Minnesota. I'm speaking on behalf of our faculty and students and staff. I'm not representing the administration, from whom I believe you will hear in a few weeks' time. I've prepared my comments today. I've also given you a handout with a couple pages that feel willing more than write some notes, and I'll be more than willing to entertain questions when I'm finished. In my email correspondence with Jim Geltman, who contacted me about testifying today, he mentioned you were most interested in hearing from me regarding the impact of rising tuition. He said you're most interested in having a face place on what must seem to you at all times to be an anonymous sea of information. My intent is to give you a brief anecdotal recounting of the tuition issue from student, staff, and faculty perspectives based on encounters and discussions I had with folks on the UMD campus the past few weeks. Allow me to begin by recounting a personal experience in my life. Both my wife, who has her PhD from the Twin Cities campus, and I, having earned my master's from the School of Education here in the Twin Cities campus, have benefited greatly from the sound decisions of previous Minnesota legislatures and the exceptional education provided us in part from Minnesota taxpayers. Of course, we well knew what we were the beneficiaries of upon graduating from the U. In 1995, my wife took an appointment at the University of Louisville, and we left Minnesota. Time transpired, and our lives in Kentucky were fine, but we longed to return to the quality of life we'd come to cherish in Minnesota. When my wife saw the posting for a German professorship at UMD in 2001, we were exuberant. She applied and was offered the position, and we returned to Minnesota with our two daughters. We fully expected to return up and pick up exactly where we had left off in 1995. Working hard but also being able to enjoy the benefits of a well-thought-through, well-financed support network, whether it be the state park system, the public services provided by state municipalities, or an education, were only some of the quality of life enhancements for which we'd longed to return to upon leaving Kentucky. However, slowly we realized that indeed much had changed since 1995, and they were not going to enjoy all the former things they had created such a high quality of life in the Minnesota we come to expect in the 80s until the mid-90s. Indeed, we read in the papers today that Minnesota is still one of the top three states in the nation in ACT and SAT college entrance test scores. And we believe that our colleges and universities are some of the most sought after in the nation, if not in parts of the world. New institutes and buildings seem to be rising on all of the four University of Minnesota campuses, thanks to your support. Each year, we see new buildings, all funded by the generosity of Minnesotans and the legislature. However, all is not well, and a place at the table of higher education comes with a price. I will argue that access to higher ed is slipping away from the grasp of many young people in Minnesota today. The cost of an education, according to an NPR report 10 days ago, having risen by 75% between 1995 and 2006, is simply unattainable for a rapidly increasing percentage of our young people. Or at least receiving that education, and those educational services have dramatically changed in two ways. Number one, the Minnesota legislature previously was committed to paying a much larger share of the tuition bill, I believe approximately 67%. That has today dropped below 30%. Point number two, students and parents are today paying themselves a much larger share for that education. The result? The average UMD student is carrying upwards of $25,000 in debt. I just spoke with a colleague yesterday on the staff who has two children in college. She's taken a second mortgage on her home to finance the two university studies, and she's very worried about how the third child is going to pay for her tuition. Students continue attempting to cope with these tuition bills. A recent poll at UMD showed that 40% of our students work 0 hours weekly. However, 42% of those responding work over 25 hours weekly. I just asked three of my German studies students at our German conversation group last Friday how much they each worked every week. One responded by saying 32 hours. One 17 and the third 15. They all confirmed that this is typical for almost everyone they know on the UMD campus. This heavy student work schedule impacts the classroom, student work ethic, and in the long term, what we as instructors begin to expect from our students. Are we able to give them assignments we'd like to, knowing full well they have such long hours of work outside of class? What about the outside of class presentations they prepare with their peers? The students are increasingly telling us they can't find time to meet to plan and learn together due to their hectic schedules. Indeed, we are asking teenagers to work two jobs when the task of attending a university should be their primary concern. They should be spending time educating themselves and their peers, engaging their instructors in debates in class, and not trying to jostle work schedules at Red Lobster. The finances are driving their decisions. And increasingly, those decisions about what to study are being shaped by less than ideal considerations. I'm increasingly having advisees come to me. We have, at the University of Minnesota, three hats we wear. One is an instructor, one some of the colleagues' research, and the third would be advisement, academic advisement. I am increasingly having advisees come to me telling me they love studying German, but their parents are telling them it's possibly not the best use of their parents' limited funds. The parents encourage them to study something more practical, something that will likely receive a job quickly after having graduated from the university. A discipline such as accounting or finance or engineering is much preferred by many. The problem is, the students oftentimes don't enjoy those areas of study, much less wish to be employed later in life in those fields. I vividly remember when a former German studies chemistry double major advisee of mine, dropped me an email while I was with students in Berlin. She wanted to see me in Berlin, in Germany. I was puzzled because I knew she just graduated from UMD. We met in Berlin for lunch one day, and Andy shared with me she'd only studied chemistry these past 5 years so that her folks would pay for her degree. Now it was time for her to enjoy her passion, German. She was hoping to instruct English as a foreign language to East German professionals who until 1989 had learned Russian and not English. Another anecdote was just shared with me yesterday at our UE exec committee meeting by Carmen Lateral, a colleague in mathematics. She says she frequently talks with young students who are engineering majors merely because their parents want them to be. The parents tell them they will likely receive high-paying jobs right out of college. Carmen says these young people often only have one wish, flunk the course, so that they might show their parents it's not an appropriate field of study for them. But then the dilemma, who pays? Indeed, the statistics at UMD show that CLA, College of Liberal Arts, is still a vital portion of the university, according to Richard Liu, who works in administration. Fully one-third of the total tuition dollars last year at UMD were brought into the coffers of the university through liberal education credits. I would argue that a broad-based education is still the cornerstone of an informed, critically engaged citizenry. The question, of course, is at what price are we willing to pay for this high quality, and who is to pay the lion's share? Currently, as the legislature pays a decreasing amount of the tuition bill, the deficit is made up by rising tuition paid by the students or their parents, or, as my colleague Moore said, increasing amounts of debt. There's a long-term discussion here that Minnesotans and our elected officials need to have. What level of publicly financed university instruction are we willing to pay for in Minnesota? Indeed, as some programs of study receive more federal grants or more monies from wealthy donors, do the heart and soul of the university, as we classically know it, begin to become more an extension of private enterprise? If indeed we are, as faculty providing services to our clients and not students, what might be some of the consequences. I have a colleague in Spanish who submitted a failing mark for a student in one of his courses. The student's parents became very agitated and contacted the dean of CLA and later administration in Darland at UMD. The concern, the student had paid dearly for the class, $1,000 for 4 credits, and wanted to have some passing record for the course. In the worst sense, the course had become a commodity that the client had purchased, and she felt entitled to own it. This is far different than what we wish were happening in the classroom. I also spoke with several staff people at UMD. One of them, Rory Litwin, our world language specialist, working at the fantastic UMD library, which I would invite you all to see. You have paid for a portion of that. He told me, actually, the access to databases via electronic subscription, funds for purchasing texts for the library holdings, and in general, the state of the facility are quite good. The problem is the extremely low wages the P&E employees there receive. They have a policy, apparently, in the library, Rory states, whereby new hires are not to earn more annually than their veteran peers. This leads to a starting salary of around $35,000. Rory says that in 10 years, many veteran staff will retire, and he worries they will be left with a wonderful facility and expansive, high-quality holdings, but no one highly qualified remains to staff the facility in assisting the students. As dollars become much more scarce, we are allocating them in ways we should be worried about. In closing, I've brought to you no solutions today. I'm not sure I have any. I do know that the University of Minnesota isn't failing, nor is it falling apart in front of our eyes. But that might just be our problem, is declining by degrees. To quote a recent text title by Richard H. Hirsch and John Merrill, we aren't seeing a dramatic sliding into mediocrity, but we are seeing many warning signs, many of which I hope I've been able to elaborate on today. My intent was to give you names of Minnesotans and describe their dilemmas. Minnesotans who, like you, are very concerned and very passionate about public education. They see the political changes from November 2006 and look to you to not try to make things the way they were for me in the 80s. That they know is impossible. But they're hoping for so much more than we've been willing to offer them the past 10 years. Take the steps, please, necessary to right the many wrongs committed in the past decade and offer Minnesotans, young and old, an educational system and indeed access to higher ed that a frighteningly high number of Minnesotans are quickly only dreaming about. I instructed for 12 years in the K-12 environment, and we spoke always about our mission being about the kids. This holds true for higher ed as well. They're simply bigger kids. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Mullins? Thank you for coming on today. We'll consider the statements. Appreciate it. Finally, Dr. Sullivan and Martin from the Quincy campus. Come down, please. And we were hoping to hear Representative Walker's bill. So, if you want to just begin immediately, Dr. Martin. And
Professor Sullivan's going to begin.
Oh, okay.
He's more senior. He goes first.
Go ahead. Seniority still rules, too, even though you don't unionize it. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and distinguished members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss the impact of recent state funding policies on access to and quality of higher education in the state of Minnesota, in particular at the University of Minnesota. My colleague, Professor Judith Martin, and I are delighted that this committee wants to hear about these matters from the perspective of the faculty members who do the research and teach our graduate and undergraduate students at the University of Minnesota. We'd like to remind you before beginning that we are appearing before you on our own as teachers and scholars and not as official representatives of the University of Minnesota. The views expressed are therefore our personal views. I'd like to begin with a purely personal story. I grew up in Albert Lea in the 1950s, and attended the University of Minnesota in the 1960s, graduated in 1967. My father worked at Wilson's meatpacking plant, and my mother was a nurse's aide at Good Samaritan Nursing Home. She passed away at that home a couple of years ago. When I went to the University of Minnesota, tuition was significantly less than $100, and I was able to earn enough money to pay almost all of my board and room and my tuition. by working 10 to 15 hours a week. My parents could not give me any money to pay for college. What I discovered at the U of M was astonishing. I took introductory economics from Walter Heller, who had just that very year returned from his service as President Kennedy's chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. At that time, University of Minnesota economists were inventing economic theories that were designed to create more stable and more predictable economic growth and to avoid major depressions. By golly, it's worked. I took an honors class from Robert Holt, who was reinventing the entire field of comparative politics and later became the dean of the graduate school, and I might say one of its most creative deans ever. I could multiply these examples extensively. Back time. There are many world-class scholars here right now at the university who are inventing bold new knowledge and conducting the best research in the world in many fields. Frankly, I believe that the university is right now on the verge of a great leap forward, similar to the experience of the 1950s and 1960s. The quality of our young faculty is just amazing. My department alone has 19 assistant professors who are terrific. Despite the world-class nature of my own experience at the U of M, my personal investment in my higher education was so modest because the state of Minnesota was committed to funding this treasure and to keeping it accessible to all who were qualified. I wouldn't have gone otherwise. A relatively small state in the Midwest developed a university that ranked in the top tier, nationally and internationally, that attracted the best, most exciting scholars in the world that came from all over the world. Leo Hurwicz in the economics department came from Budapest after the war. One after another, I could give you many names. They inspired generations of young Minnesotans to develop fully their potential and in most cases to use that potential to enrich the state of Minnesota. Now, as chair of a large social science department, with large numbers of majors and student credit hours, I see daunting challenges that must be met in order to maintain the excellence that I have experienced as a student and a faculty member at the university. Depending on how and when you count them, my department has between 750 and 900 majors. They declare every day. So if you count them in the fall, you may start out with 750, and by the end of spring, you might have 900. Depends on when you count them and how you count them. That's about half the size of the entire student body at Carleton and McAllister Colleges, one department. We have slightly more than 30 full-time faculty members in the department. In contrast, Carleton has 198 full-time faculty members and McAllister has 186. We would have to more than double the size, the number, of full-time faculty in my department at an initial cost of several millions of dollars per year to offer a similar student-faculty ratio. We are only one of many such large quality departments at the university. According to the last two surveys of graduating seniors, approximately 70% of my students, majors, graduated in 4 years or less. Not bad. There are so many of them. In the last few years, five of our undergraduate majors have won prestigious and extremely competitive Rhodes or Truman scholarships, about the same number of Rhodes scholarships as have been won by students from Carleton or McAllister, just one department. We also maintain one of the premier graduate programs in the country, with almost 300 applicants every year, from which we accept and matriculate about 12 per year. 12 out of 300. We place our PhDs at top colleges and universities all over the world. Our graduate program was rated third in quality among all public universities in the world in the National Research Council study. In the last two decades, 15 members of my department have won outstanding undergraduate teaching awards, and three have won graduate teaching awards. We work incredibly hard to provide an outstanding education to all of our students, and there are a lot of them. The stresses on department chairs who are attempting to maintain this very high level of accessibility and quality have multiplied in recent years. Because of the continuing reverberations of funding shortages, exacerbated when we took the rather large state budget cuts a few years ago, it is increasingly difficult to meet the cost of high-quality graduate and undergraduate education and to retain the top faculty who are in great demand nationally and internationally. Just this month, my department lost its best undergraduate instructor, an amazing teacher, to another university on the East Coast. And this year alone, Harvard has attempted to recruit three other members of my department.
This attests to the quality of what we have now, and it attests to the daunting challenges that remain in trying to retain that quality in an increasingly competitive arena. Our department insists that although some of our classes must be large, the quality should be as high as if the classes were more intimate. This is difficult to do. For example, I teach classes at both the graduate and undergraduate level, despite the fact that being chair is now a full-time job. One of the undergraduate courses I am teaching right now has 120 students in it. It closed. You can't let any more in. Each student is required to write 4 essays of 4 to 6 pages, and I and my teaching assistants provide significant feedback on each essay. The quality improves vastly. You wouldn't believe the improvement in quality from the 1st to the 4th essay because we take the time to provide significant feedback. This totals to about 2,800 pages of writing to be read, assessed, commented upon, and graded, not including the midterm or final examinations. I have taught this course at Carleton College several times, where I typically had to grade about 400 pages to achieve the same level of quality. Having our graduate students, who are professors in training, to assist with this work allows me to run the department, teach graduate seminars, supervise graduate student research, conduct my own research, write my own books, edit books, and still offer very high-quality undergraduate classes to hundreds of students, not 20, not 30, hundreds. At the moment, it is unlikely that we can continue to afford graduate student assistance to maintain this quality. The national and international competition for top graduate students has increased our costs immensely. I have then raised 2 issues. The first is how to maintain access to a university which is capable of providing transformational experiences to all kinds of students. I'm one. The second is how to maintain quality with increasingly limited resources and large numbers of students who want and deserve to have this experience. The state's firm financial commitment is absolutely essential if we're to accomplish this. Susan?
Thank you. You have my written statement, so I'm not going to read it to you. I just emphasize a couple of things in the interest of time. Unlike Professor Sullivan and others who have spoken to you today, Mr. Chair and Madam Vice Chair, I'm not a Minnesota native. I came here voluntarily. It wasn't my parents' choice. I came to the University of Minnesota as a graduate student in the early 1970s, and my recollection is that I paid about $1,500 in out-state tuition when I came here. I was able to do that on my own from savings because I had worked, like many of our students do, 18 to 20 hours a week as an undergraduate. I went to a private school in Illinois. My own education was supported by the state of Illinois. I had an Illinois state scholarship. So my education has been building on investments made by people in many states over the last many decades. I think I'd rather than going through the thing that I wrote, I'd like to just say a couple of things. Almost all of us, as Professor Sullivan indicated, at the university do a lot of different things. There is a perception, certainly, that faculty at the university don't teach very much and we all are hiding away doing our research and not paying attention to students. I personally run a program, the Urban Studies program at the university, which has 80 to 90 majors, 20 or so minors. I'm the only faculty member. Professor Sullivan's comment about the size of the political science department compared to, you know, other colleges around the state, I think, is an appropriate one. We know at the University of Minnesota that most of our departments are undersized compared to our peers. And our peers are increasingly places that are investing an enormous amount of money in higher education because they have recognized that an investment in higher education is an investment in the economy of the state. And that's something that we are trying very hard to maintain the quality of what we're doing, but as the state support has declined, you've heard other people talking about the need for students to work and the need to pile up loans, and that's true for students at the University of Minnesota as well. I'd like to just spend a moment saying something about what we're doing about it. Tuition at the University of Minnesota has grown extraordinarily in the last 4 or 5 years, largely due to the state budget cut 4 years ago, but there are other, you know, everything is getting more expensive. Everything that all of us buy and use is more expensive. In the last several years, there has been a huge emphasis, and I know this because I'm very involved in faculty governance at the university, on trying to meet that challenge by meeting with private resources the need for scholarships. And there are two programs that have come about in the last couple of years. One is the Founders Program, which is directly, precisely at the kinds of students that the other faculty from the other campuses were talking about, the lowest income students, first generation students, students who have really no other way to go to college. The Founders Program is adding substantially to the amounts of the Pell Grants, so that approximately now $12,000 is available to students who are able to get those scholarships, which means that we are really trying very hard to keep the University of Minnesota available and accessible to students who want to come there, but like Professor Sullivan and I, had parents who couldn't help. The other program is the Promise of Tomorrow program, which has now raised $150 million privately for scholarships and fellowships, largely for undergraduate students. I was personally at a Regents meeting about 3 years ago when the scholarship that's named in the name of the Benson family was there. And the Bensons were quite extraordinary because they met at the University of Minnesota 60 years ago. They decided that they wanted to share their good fortune, having made a fair amount of money, with the university's students. And they wanted to do it while they were still alive. They wanted to do it while they could meet with the students who got the scholarships. And I've met some of the students who have gotten the Benson scholarships and met some of the other students that are getting these scholarships, and they are extraordinarily grateful. It's really making the university quite available to students who really want to come there, who want to do things like study German or study political science, and yes, study engineering and become doctors and lawyers and all of those things, but many of whom need an enormous assist in much the same way that we got a big assist getting to where we are. So my conclusion is to ask you to please help the entire University of Minnesota system and do not underfund the state's research university. We need all the help we can get. We're doing a lot on our own, but we can't do it all on our own. Thank you.
Doctors Sullivan and Martin, thank you very much for your testimony. I think we've had a lot of testimony recently from students all our different systems, public and private, and from faculty yesterday and today, and we realize that what started out as a big problem is becoming a crisis, and we appreciate your testimony very much. Thank you. Representative Walker, House File 219. Representative Walker, welcome to the committee. Representative Moe moves House File 219 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Management and Labor and Management. Management and Commerce, excuse me. Labor and Commerce. I'll get it right. Yes, Representative Mooney. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity. Quick opportunity, because I wasn't expecting it to be put on your schedule so quickly, considering the overview and testimony that you've been doing the last couple weeks. And I do want to give an apology to members, because I haven't had an opportunity to get to around to you guys to get a gauge of how you feel about this particular bill. And I also would like to apologize, because half of my gland is decided to swell up today, and so I can feel this feeling in my throat. I will be brief. The bill itself, House File 19, is just going to, hopefully, with your approval and eventually the approval of the process going to the governor, will just expand sick leave benefits going beyond children to include one's spouse, your step-parents, your parents, and your grandparents. And one of the things I think that individuals, especially those of us that have parents that are aging, and if you are in a situation where your parents want to stay at home, your parents may not have had the situation to have their economics be the way that they are, and the hardship that they may come on members of your family, your siblings, and making sure that your parents have an opportunity to stay at home. I want to make sure that I will cut myself short and make sure we get these two testifiers in, Mr. Chair, and I'll come back. That's okay.
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Okay. I'm Patty Dorsey.
Dobrodošli.
Faculty.
Dobro.
I'm Patty Jerkovich. Are we going to introduce ourselves first, or just let me speak? Okay. Thank you so much for allowing us the opportunity to come here and speak before you today. I'm here with my two small children. I'm a board member of the Alzheimer's Association. I'm an attorney in private practice. I've been volunteering with the Alzheimer's Association ever since my mother passed away from the disease. My mother died in 2001, the year that my daughter was born. And I became a caregiver at age 32 when my mother and father both developed serious health problems. My father was a retired public school teacher. My mother, a retired public health nurse. And my sisters and I took care of them in their own home for a long period of time. It was at a time when I was newly married, right out of law school, and starting private practice. And if it weren't for a very accommodating employer, I would have a very different job situation today. But over the past 9 years now, I have been on and off in a role of caregiving and desperately needed time off to take care of these people that I love so much. And just this summer, my children and I, including my little boy who had a hard time sometimes being quiet during the hearings, and I apologize for that, Peter and I spent many, many mornings with my Uncle Joe, who passed away last June from dementia. But there was a huge, they didn't have any children, my aunt and uncle didn't have children, there was a huge need for us to be there to help. And I would encourage you to allow this bill to go forward, to give it your wholehearted endorsement. It's something that families really need, and if we can't support families, we can't afford the consequences of not supporting them. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Karen Eileen, and I'm here on behalf of AARP, and also I have cared for my mother. So I have a script because it's official. Chairman Rukavina and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 219. I'm a member of AARP Grassroots Education and Advocacy Team, AARP in Minnesota numbers 670,000 members. A growing number of older persons and adults with disabilities across our state are receiving care informally by family members. In fact, unpaid family members provide 80 to 90% of the long-term care provided in society. These family caregivers are often juggling multiple roles at home and in the labor force. To better recognize the needs of family caregivers, AARP supports House File 219 legislation to allow family members to use earned sick time to care for their loved ones. A number of years ago, my mother had cancer, and I cared for her. As a nurse, I was primary. Because of my situation, I quit my job to include her care. An estimated 9% of caregivers quit their jobs to provide for care. For adult daughters, the numbers rise to 12%, and caregiving issues affect women to a greater degree because 72% of caregivers are female, mostly wives and adult daughters. Working caregivers perform a nearly impossible balancing act. Caregivers sometimes feel guilty about neglecting both sides of their lives, personal and professional, even as they are exhausting themselves trying to keep up. They miss work or need to make many personal phone calls during working hours. They may turn down opportunities for training, special assignments, or travel and miss out on promotions. Between one-third and nearly two-thirds of caregivers are employed outside of the home. This trend is likely to continue as more women continue to enter the labor force. Many families are involved in caregiving, and in fact, AARP estimates that nearly one in four U.S. households are involved in caring for a relative or friend aged 50 or older. By 2030, when the baby boomers reach age 65, one in five Americans will be at least 65, for a total of about 70 million older people, more than twice the number in 1996. In the 21st century, the demands placed on family and other informal caregivers are likely to escalate, affecting nearly every American family. A recent study by the National Alliance for Caregivers estimates that family caregivers suffer financial loss over their lifetimes equal to more than more than $650,000 in lost wages, pensions, and Social Security benefits. The study's findings also suggest that two-thirds of people providing care for elderly relatives make significant work sacrifices. What may not be factored into these figures are the increased health care resources required to treat the caregiver for symptoms of exhaustion, stress, and declining health, resulting from the demands of the job, a job that is essentially unpaid in dollars and often goes unrecognized by society. Caregiving costs our business community as well. Nationally, it is estimated that about $29 billion is lost to business each year from lost productivity, and that's from a 1997 MetLife study. When my mother needed care and my help, there wasn't another consideration. There would always be another job, but I only had one mother. Additionally, as a nurse, I know that I gave the best care to patients. That best care needs to be available for our loved ones as well. I urge you to pass this legislation to better recognize the significant sacrifice made by family caregivers all over our state, and thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Watt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just closing, I believe what you testified has really summed it up perfectly. Just to note that as a daughter, my mother did have six living children, there is an extra burden that the two of her daughters have versus the other four boys that have and always will have as it relates to running errands or taking care, doing medical appointments for my mother. And that's just, not that some of you men may not have that role, especially my sister has three boys. One of them are going to have to own up. In addition to that, many of our families, as stated before, they have the sick time. Unfortunately, the employers may have the guidelines that do not allow them to utilize the expansion of the definition that we're trying to get in this bill. And in conclusion, I want the same benefits for citizens of Minnesota that I have. If I get sick, or if my mother gets sick or ill, or my partner is not well or injured, I'm not calling my employer saying I need time off. I have the opportunity to let my legislative assistant know, to let my chairs know of the committee that I'm not going to be there, and then I'm gone. Thank you.
Questions on the bill? Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina, and yes. What I'd like to start out with is I do not have an issue with expanding this to family members, but I have to put on my hat as a small business owner. And I know currently we do expand this to our employees, but my concern is the portion of the bill on line 1.10 where you say a reasonable period of as the employee's attendance may be necessary. Is there a limit on that? And then I do have some other questions.
Representative McFarland, that would be current law, you know, already, and so I don't know how it's been.
What is the interpretation of reasonable?
Ms. Novak, did you happen to hear the question? Ms. Novak, Representative McFarland asked about on line 110 what a reasonable period would be interpreted under current state law.
I guess the reason I bring it up is because in the letter from the Alzheimer's Association, they talk about family leave, and is that the same as sick leave?
Mr. Chairman and Representative McFarland, it is sick leave benefit. So family leave in this act is sick leave benefit.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the Alzheimer's Association defines it as. And as to reasonable periods of time, I believe that's subject to interpretation. It's not defined.
And is that still up to each company's policies that they come up with?
That would be my assumption, that it would be under the policies of the employee.
Okay. And I guess my concern would be the cost to the employer for such a thing. I understand, like I say, I'm for this, but at the same time, I'm looking out for the businesses side.
Well, you realize this, I believe, applies to employers of 20 or more? No,
Mr. Chairman and members of employer, in this case, is public and private employers, individuals, corporations, profit and non-profit employers of 21 more or more employees at a single site.
Okay.
Representative Haas.
Thank you very much. I think our rules are going to have to adjust to the flow of the baby boomers because every 6.7 seconds now somebody in the United States is celebrating their 60th birthday. And I think we have to start adapting those. I'm a past board member of Alzheimer's Association and AARP board, and I would say that this is very important. And you would think most companies would be doing it naturally and wouldn't need a law to do this, but maybe we do need a law.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I'm one of those baby boomers. I think the key word that I heard over there was that it's earned. Sick leave benefits are earned, that the employee has earned. I know in my school district, these are days that I've earned, and they do apply it to my spouse and to my children. What about the person who's new on the job hasn't earned a number of days to apply for this situation?
Representative Walker, do you want to take that on? Your Honor, if I could please... Your Honor.
That never happen again.
I'll buy you a black robe next week.
I don't know who's more insulted, the judges or Tom.
If I may step in, when I was reading this and before I came to testify, I was under the understanding that the personal sick leave benefits accrued, which is part of what you're asking, but part of also what you were asking, would mean, if as an attorney in private practice, I have no personal sick leave benefits accrued. But however, if I did, I would be able to drain those down, and when I exhausted those, that's when my understanding of family medical leave would kick in. And that's unpaid leave unless your employer chooses to pay for it. That's typically what I did was I went on unpaid leave, and everybody at the firm thought I was a complete freak for not taking a paycheck, but I needed to be there for my family. So that was my understanding. So if somebody didn't have accrued sick days, then they would have to go on unpaid leave. But I'm not sure when family medical leave then kicks in, if you have to be in there a year working for that employer.
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt.
Any other attorneys who are acquainted with us?
We don't need any other attorneys.
We need Mr. Chair.
Your Honor.
Representative Ortman. We'll get a few attorneys on, then I'll give my interpretation, and I got the gavel.
That was my area of expertise when I was practicing law as an employee and employer. This area. Family Medical Leave Act only applies to employees who have reached a certain number of hours per year. I believe it's 1,200 hours with the employer and been employed for at least a year. But it's a federal law. This only affects people who have accrued sick leave. It doesn't change what federal law provides. Can't add or subtract to it. But this only deals with how can you use your sick leave that you've accrued.
That was my understanding of
right. And remember, members, this applies only to those, you know, employers that have a sick leave policy or a union, maybe it's a union negotiated thing or a voluntary thing.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Walker.
The other thing that's really important is not like we're expanding the law. This isn't new policy per se. It's already sick leave that you can utilize for your child. It's just an expansion of being able to utilize your own sick leave that you have occurred.
Seeing no further questions, then all those in favor signify. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's obviously a great benefit. I mean, I think every person that works under sick leave would see the value in having this. I guess the question that I have is there's, especially when you get into the private sector, there's a wide range of how sick leave policies have been determined. Some companies have very liberal sick leave policies, allow lots of accumulation. People can, you know, you know, they can all, some can accumulate almost indefinitely. Others, you know, you use it or you lose it at the end of the year. And it just seems like this kind of broad brush kind of approach really leaves employers who have built their, you know, compensation system kind of out of, you know, hanging out. I mean, if they were an employer that had 20 employees or 21 employees that just fell under this issue, if they had a liberal policy and someone had an issue in their family and a mother or father or loved one that needed to take, an employee could all of a sudden, because of a legislative action, take a ton of time off. And the employee would be required to pay for it for something they could not have taken time off had this not passed. So I guess I'm seeing it as being a very inequitably distributed policy when you bring it out to all of the unique hybrids of how employers handle sick leave, and I guess that concerns me a lot. I think it's I don't know what the costs are or how it would distribute out. But I just think it's the question that I would have that I'd like to see answered or at least talked about, you know, before or thought about before the bill would move on and in final form. So I just offer that to the
Representative Eason, let me say that the fiscal note was requested last Thursday for this, and we haven't received it yet. But this bill is going to travel to Representative Atkins committee, and then I believe to the State Government Finance Committee. So there will be a finance note, and it'll travel through at least two other committees with a fiscal note present then at that time. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, could I ask, is the fiscal note going to include costs to private employers?
No, Mr. Representative Easton, the fiscal notes don't ever, you know, our fiscal notes are the cost of state government.
I guess, and that's my concern, is I don't know if the fiscal note will address this issue. I don't know if we could ever get a handle on this issue, and I guess that's what I'm concerned about, is how this affects the private employers with a myriad of different kinds of sick leave plans in there that are already in operation.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to kind of hear from the business sector on this one. I know that we're bunched up against time, but I would anticipate in the next hearings that they'll have a voice. I think Mr. Hickey's here from NFIB.
The Commerce and Labor Committee will definitely be having their input, and if Mr. Hickey or Mr. Hestie wants to come down and testify on this, they're more than welcome to.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a note, Representative Stevenson, no one has contacted me outside of the department who has some concerns and some challenges with this bill. Representative Eastland, you know, to respond to some of your concerns, the big thing here is, to me, isn't about causing more hardship for the business community, the nonprofits, or even the public sector. This is already an expansion of what they currently use. It doesn't say that they have to change the way that they utilize their sick time right now. We have our unions who negotiate under their contracts on how they want to accrue time. We have different sectors that don't offer sick time. We have other sectors that say if you work 10 days, you get a half an hour and things of that nature. That part doesn't change. The amount of hours and the flexibility that an employer has to decide the policy itself doesn't change. The only thing that changes with this legislation is giving the opportunity to utilize that accrued time for your other family members that you might want to take care of. And lastly, that I think it's really important to say is the individuals that, you know, your child is precious to you, my son is precious to me. However, my mother is just as precious to me. And any opportunity that I have to help her, when that time comes, I want to be able to utilize that. But it doesn't really change the policies if individuals want to, the last thing, Mr. Chair, is really, there are some employers that say you have to show, give a note, a doctor's note, and things of that nature. Whatever your policies are with your company is what you would still have to follow up.
Mr. Chair? If I may address the gentleman's concerns over there, I think everyone in business is well aware of the cost of recruiting and retaining talented, dedicated people. And I think if you afford this
additional benefit to employees to be able to take care of their loved ones, you're going to be able to recruit and retain your workforce at a higher rate. Otherwise, you're going to have to do what my colleague here next to me did, but leave her job. And finding a good, qualified, trained nurse in your facility is not an easy thing. And I'm sure the Nursing Association and the Hospital Association can testify to that. So it's a cost that society is going to bear one way or another.
Representative Moe renews his motion. House File 219 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Committee is adjourned.